I'm going to take you through the rest of our top-level conclusions fairly quickly here. So climate change's potential to affect global food security matters for the U.S. This is kind of a U.S.-centric finding, but it matters for other nations, too. It's going to affect, all nations are kind of embedded in a global food system, and they're connected. And so the U.S. and other nations could see increased costs for imports and increased demand for exports. Regions with relatively low yields per hectare are going to want advanced methods and technologies from more advanced regions and advanced producers, and an increased incidence of weather extremes like extended drought could increase the number of food shocks and could thus increase demands for emergency assistance. So you can really see the effects of climate change can kind of propagate through this the interlinked food systems of the world. The risks extend well beyond agricultural production, as Secretary Vilsack and Meg have both emphasized. Two other elements of the global food systems that are really important for food security, really in a big way, processing and storage, transportation, and consumption of food. Increased temperatures are going to require more effective processing and storage to avoid the risk of increased spoilage and increased waste. And we just saw from Meg that waste is a major issue now. We don't want to do anything to exacerbate that problem. Transportation is likely to be more often affected by extreme weather conditions. In particular, lower levels in rivers and lakes can affect large-scale transportation of food. And increased temperatures also affect food safety, increasing risks from bacteria and fungal infections. And very interestingly, increased concentrations of CO2 themselves appear to reduce key micronutrients in some crops, including iron and zinc. So there's a lot of factors at play here. Accurately projecting these risks requires consideration of a lot of other large-scale changes. It's not just about climate in isolation. It's about the interplay of climate change and lots of other physical and socioeconomic changes. Population growth increases risk and vulnerability, while economic growth in general reduces vulnerability. Urbanization increases transportation, storage, and packaging needs, all of which can be affected by climate change. And ecosystem degradation can affect water supplies and healthy soils that really are the foundation of the production that underlies the entire food system across the globe. The risks really scale according to how much climate change there is. As the magnitude and rate of climate change increases, food security risk also increases. High emissions and concentrations of greenhouse gases are much more likely to have damaging effects than lower emissions and concentration trajectories. And so in the worst case, remembering again that we need to think about more than climate change, but in a case where high emissions and high population growth are coupled with low economic growth, we could see an increase of approximately 175 million hungry people over the roughly 800 million that Meg alluded to earlier. But that's a very negative socioeconomic scenario combined with a negative climate scenario. If we have lower emissions, but we still have the negative socioeconomic factors of high population growth and low economic growth, we could be looking at roughly 60 million more people that are hungry. But if we can somehow couple low emissions and lower population growth with somewhat higher economic growth, we could still continue to make significant progress in reducing the number of hungry people. And I think that's a very important point here, is that a lot of these outcomes are really subject to future human decisions and what negotiators here do, and what economic managers and people all around the world do as well. We've talked a bit about adaptation already, and it's certainly true that effective adaptation can reduce food system vulnerability to climate change and reduce detrimental effects. The agricultural community and other, the agricultural producers and other food system actors have a very strong record of innovation and creativity and adaptability demonstrated really over the course of the last century. What's occurred with food production is truly amazing, and reductions in hunger. And it appears that further adaptation is feasible, but we have to recognize that adaptive capacity is likely to have limits. It's not infinite. And there are a lot of factors that can impede it. And we list a few of them on this slide, but primarily poverty, lack of access to finance and credit, low education levels, and simply not sharing lessons learned can all have very negative effects on the uptake and effectiveness of adaptation strategies. Meg talked about the food system and the complexity of the food system. And when you look at that complexity versus the complexity of climate change, one of the things you realize is that there are multiple opportunities for adaptation interventions across the food system. On the production side, it's possible to modify and enhance crops through breeding. You can grow different crops. You can alter practices on the farm. All those still have significant potential to improve the situation. Transportation networks can be extended and improved. It's a huge issue in many parts of the world, simply not having adequate transportation to get food from the producers to the market, and improved transportation can make a very large positive difference. And there are all kinds of techniques, both new techniques and traditional techniques for storage. It's likely that we're going to have a greater need for increased cold storage. That also has energy implications and a negative feedback into the whole climate change challenge. But traditional practices like drying and salting and pickling, things like that, really have potential to help deal with this issue as well. And of course, it's also possible to alter consumption practices. One of the things, as you study this issue, that you realize is that everyone can't have the same habits and preferences that are enjoyed in the U.S. and Europe today. The food system can't handle having everyone consume at that level. So there's a lot that can be done. And finally, I want to emphasize and zero in a little bit on trade as an adaptation option. What I'm showing you here is two different scenarios, or two sets of scenarios. The ones circled in green are relatively low greenhouse gas emissions coupled with moderate trade on the left. And when you introduce freer trade into that scenario, the price effect of climate change goes down. So the free trade in a relatively low emissions scenario seems to have a positive effect on price. Positive, that it lessens price relative to what it would be without free trade. The set of scenarios on the other side, circled in red, are a high emissions and very restricted trade world. And in that kind of a world, the modeling evidence is pretty firm that you see that the prices are higher overall. But when there is when there's trade restriction and then you introduce additional trade restriction, the prices go up even further. So on both sides of this equation, it appears that that having free trade and, you know, I would add fair trade is necessary coupled with that. But it really does appear that trade is one of the major options that we have, both to help keep prices down, which feeds back on access and availability of food, but it's also a very effective mechanism to get food to where it's needed, from regions that have food and produce it effectively to regions that may be experiencing temporary dislocations or other difficulties. I guess I have more on that. But with that, those are our main conclusions.